When you've called me out on something that I'm obviously doing wrong, my only retort is that you don't love me for me. God forbid someone challenges you to be better. God forbid someone sees something in you and has asked you to step up. God forbid someone is challenging you to grow with them. God forbid. What a horrible thing.
Seriously.
Are you shitting me?
Yeah.
I hate seeing this. Welcome back. Welcome back.
That was a good one.
To another episode of Till the Wheels Fall Off. I'm Matt.
I'm Paige.
Good episode today coming up, requested by the Wheelies.
Yes.
On Dry Drunk. What is it? What does it mean? What do I do about it? Is there a cure for this? We have answers to all of these questions and more. Many of these are Wheelie submitted questions.
Yeah, I was going to say, I asked people to submit some questions on this topic and we got some good ones.
I'm pumped about this one.
Yeah.
But first, I need y'all to listen to this one. Seriously, this is an important announcement. If there's anything that we could ask for from you as an audience, as a listener base, it would be take a moment to follow the show, subscribe to the show, and leave us a review. It means so much to us to hear that people are getting help. And like, I tear up when I read these things. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. We got two this week that were really, really good.
Yeah, they were great.
So sweet. If you're listening, you left those, like we read them and like you truly touched our hearts.
Yes.
It helps the show grow. It helps the show grow. Like our goal is ultimately to be able to do this like all the time. This is what we want to do with our lives, is to help other people. Like it's selfish in some ways. I feel like we get so much from it too,
mm-hmm.
you know, like having to come out here publicly and like process all this stuff,
yeah. But
it helps other people. And that's what I love hearing about. And if it's helped you, take a moment and leave a review for others so that they know that this thing exists. The more reviews, the more it's pushed out and people can discover us easier. There are so many people in need of help in this situation, and you can be the reason that they end up stumbling across it. If you'll take the time and submit a review, we'd really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we've got a workshop coming up on June 8th.
Yay.
I cannot wait for this thing, for the simple fact that it's a chance to get everyone in a room.
Yes.
And like be with everyone in a place where we can talk about this stuff openly without the internet in between us. And like,
it's
we're all there.
It's different than virtually.
Yeah. Having a real conversation about this stuff is completely different. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. Like we've gotten to meet some of you and I love getting the chance to meet Wheelies.
Yeah.
I've had coffee with some and it's so great. Mm-hmm. It's so great. So a chance to do that. And there's a lot of value packed into this thing. It's a full day, 9 to 4 with us. We've got an agenda on our website, www.tufo.com, where you can sign up and you don't have to be in town. We're holding this thing in McKinney, Texas, just north of Dallas. But hey, you can make a weekend of it because we've got a meetup the following day.
Yep.
So a chance to really invest in your recovery. Think of it as a retreat. More to come on retreats in the future. But for now, we are going with workshops. I think this is where we can provide the most help for people. Would love to see as many people as possible out there. What do you got on workshops?
Oh, I'm so pumped. I'm so excited. I want to meet people.
Without sounding like we're begging and pleading people, like, come on, please, we want to meet you.
No,
we want you
I'm
to be
just
there.
Excited. I think this is a great step for us and people on their healing journey. You're going to get a lot out of this. I promise.
Yeah, seriously. Do it.
Yep.
It's going to be awesome. Something I've got here on the desk. This is really cool. This was actually sent in by a listener, this idea. Mike, thank you for this idea. This is so freaking cool. It's a great idea. So I just celebrated 13 years sober on, sorry, not 13, 11 years sober. It's the 13th.
Yeah.
On the 13th, I celebrated
I was like,
11
dang,
years sober. I skipped ahead in time. 11 years sober on the 13th, which was this last Saturday. It's always a really important day for our family, for our mm-hmm. family. Like this is the day that the trajectory of our family completely changed. And I remember when I got my 1 year chip, like you were proud of me, but there was a part of you that was like, man, like that was earned not just by you. Certainly you were the one who went to the meetings, you quit the drinking, but there's so much that goes into sobriety, so much that goes into sobriety, and partners don't really get a token. So
we are the ones who are by your side through the addiction and through the recovery, and we get to see everything firsthand and we deal with the repercussions.
Yeah.
You know?
And the patience that you guys display mm-hmm. for those of you that have been through it with someone who's sober today, the patience that is not deserved by any means, but is given freely is truly grace. And it shouldn't go unrecognized. So Mike gave me this idea to make a recovery rock. So it's got a Tufo logo on the front, and on the back it says, "Thank you for being my rock."
It's so cute. I love it.
So cool. It's a cool token. So if you're someone who's in recovery, we've got a lot of couples that listen to the episodes together, which I think is amazing. I think that's how you, if you really want to strengthen a marriage and see each other's perspectives, that's what it's designed for.
And strengthen your recovery.
It's so all good for your recovery.
It's been so beneficial.
To help you see parts that took me years to see, to be able to see them earlier, mm-hmm. is beneficial.
Yeah.
So those are available on our website, tufo.com, if you want to check one out. It's really cool. So this is your rock. This is your rock.
You
earned that rock.
Thank you.
And many, many more.
I think it's the coolest thing ever.
Many, many more. Yeah. It was really, really, really cool weekend for us. It's always a great occasion. Like, I get super emotional. I know that you do too.
Oh, it was like our most emotional one.
I think we learned more this last year than we have any year prior.
Yeah, it comes out in layers. And we talk about that all the time, that recovery is a long process and there will be layers that are removed probably the rest of our lives.
For sure.
But it gets stronger and we learn from it and it's beautiful.
It can be a beautiful journey if you commit to it.
Yeah.
It really, really can.
Yep.
Next thing, hey, course is still out there and the mini courses are still up.
Yes, I have one mini course that's still up.
Okay, wasn't even aware of this until we got an order for one. I was like,
surprise, hey. I left it up.
But the course is still up, Independently Strong, and you can find that by going to our website, tufo.com or independentlystrong.com. Something we are going to start doing for people who buy the course. So we do some free community calls as often as we can. Very, very busy schedules. It's kind of crazy. But here very soon, we're going to be scheduling weekly calls. Paige will be holding weekly calls for
the students.
For students who have purchased the course, mm-hmm. to process what's going on in the course. I think that's probably the best way to get the most out of the content.
Agreed.
Because it can be challenging. It's mm-hmm. stuff that no one really wants to look at, and it's tough to do alone. Mm-hmm. And it's designed, like, you're not alone. We're there. Dr. Taylor's there.
Yeah.
But to be able to process it with wheelies, it's sort of like a workshop.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of people, we've had some people say that they are scared to get the course.
Yeah.
Because it's different than anything out there and they may not be ready to see the reality of their situation. And I think that's beautiful to be honest about that. And I understand that. And I mean, I totally get it. But there's so much more to this course than just that. Like, it is such an empowering process.
It's huge. It's huge. And people that have gone through it can tell you. And their reviews and their testimonials are out there as well. That is life-changing. Like, people that have said, like, this saved me, like, thousands. This would have saved me thousands and thousands in therapy. Mm-hmm. And hours of just toiling my mind and trying to figure things out when it's laid out there. It's laid out there. So if you want what we have, do what we did. It's going to empower you. That is the goal of the course, is to empower you. Like, we are not here to teach anybody how to tolerate abusive behaviors or how to manage it better. We're here to empower people to make decisions. And so if that means that you decide that you're willing to stick this out and you want to stick around, you will be empowered to know right from wrong. You will know what boundaries look like in that relationship.
Yeah.
And for some others where it's like, listen, we're split and I don't know what to do next. It's for you too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got
a partner
who's in recovery and you're still together, it is for you too.
Yeah.
Like, I think that maybe that's even, from a recovery standpoint, like, that extra layer of accountability, mm-hmm. and understanding about what's really going on, because you can't go to my meetings and figure out what we're talking about or really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
This, it's all out here now. She will know as much as you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So what does that do? That'll put you in a position where it's like, I got to do this now.
Yeah.
Like, I can't sell any more snake oil. I can't BS. Mm-hmm. I can't beat around the bush on stuff. Like, she knows.
Yeah.
And that's valuable. That's a valuable tool for your recovery.
For sure.
So it's great. It's out there. You can get 75% off with the code WHEELIES75. That's WHEELIES with an S at the end, 75. And I think that it's it, right?
Yes.
Okay. We've got a loaded one tonight.
Making my head like this because I'm sure there's something we're missing, but it's okay.
It's a late night.
I really want to talk about this.
You going to stick with me?
Yeah. I've been looking forward to this episode, and here's mainly why.
Okay.
Some people don't really know what the term dry drunk means, and some people do, but if you've listened to us long enough, you know that I'm very big on looking at behaviors and not substances.
That's like your might be your biggest like.
That's my biggest, your biggest thing point. Where I try to just kind of, you know, educate others to utilize that stance instead of, you know, just focusing on the substance, because we have experience where if you remove the substance, the behavior is still there. And even though when you were using, you were more of a closet addict, and I paid attention to your behaviors because they went against my values. So when we talk about this dry drunk thing, it's no different than somebody who's using. You focus on the behaviors. So I was just really excited to talk about this because it kind of goes along with my ideas on how I approach things.
Yeah, and it's really good following up on the last episode too. I think these things sort of go hand in hand. This is going to be a good one. I'm looking forward to it.
What was our last episode? Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. I blanked on it now.
Yeah, I'm like, what are you
talking about? You don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So what are other words for dry drunk? Have you heard?
Dry drunk's the most common one I've ever heard.
It's from AA.
It's not mentioned in the book or anything else. I think it's sort of like a, what's,
I looked it up online and it said it was from what's his name.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not aware of it in the book. I mean, I could be.
You know the book really well. So now I'm wondering where this information came from.
I know it's a term given to someone that's removed the substance, but the behaviors remain.
Like, yes.
They're essentially like you're acting exactly the same, but there's no substance involved now. Therefore, you're a dry drunk. So I've mentioned Celeste Yvonne's book before. Mm-hmm. It's not about the wine. And she has an amazing story of recovery, specifically for mothers, talking about mommy wine culture. She's a great voice in sobriety. I subscribe to her Substack. And if you're someone that listens to this and you're in recovery, I would suggest, listen, man, woman, doesn't matter. It's an amazing story. But she gave the best definition of dry drunk that I've ever read. And so I'm going to read that real quick.
Okay.
So she says, when I first started writing about my recovery publicly, someone called me a dry drunk on social media, and I had no idea what they meant. After an intense Google search, I learned that a dry drunk is considered someone who has cut out alcohol but hasn't done the work. And that's in quotes, quote unquote, the work. We often hear about the work.
I say it all the time.
Yep. While this particular person was referring to the work of the 12-step program in AA, I'd prefer to think that the work refers to anything you do to achieve emotional sobriety. I recognize that some hard-lined AAers would argue against this, but as you know, I believe there are numerous alternatives to AA. Emotional sobriety is learning to regulate your emotions to endure the kind of feelings that previously triggered your drinking. Read that one more time. Emotional sobriety is learning to regulate your emotions to endure the kind of feelings that previously triggered your drinking. And she says that people can achieve this through all sorts of self-work, healing, therapy, and practice. There isn't just one answer. Mm-hmm. And she's right about that.
I believe that, but I do believe that there is a lot that goes into it. I don't think one weekly session of therapy is going to...
Probably not. And we'll get into like, how do you get out of dry drunk? And like, what does it really take? And I'll talk about my experience of finding emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
Which is what it's really about. Mm-hmm. That's what we're after here. Mm-hmm. That's what we're after. So... bit of a story real quick. What's wrong?
Nothing.
What's the matter?
Nothing's
the matter. Man, you were like testy tonight.
So testy. My face is like no poker face tonight.
You snapped at me like 100 times. I'm scared to say anything.
I did snap at you earlier and I apologize for that.
My goodness.
It was not good. And now I'm just giving him an eye, but
yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay. Are we going to talk about a story that happened with you?
Yeah, kind of. I'm going to talk about dry drunk. If that's okay with you. Just making sure before I go any further.
Okay.
Okay, I volunteered at a treatment center. I've mentioned this before and took a meeting up there tonight. And this was the topic because we were talking about this in the podcast tonight. I'm like, this is actually a really great topic because I don't think a lot of people understand this, especially in treatment. When I checked into treatment, I wanted to stop, actually not even stop drinking. I wanted to learn how to manage my drinking. That's what I went in there doing. I was like, they're going to teach me how to manage this. They're going to teach me how to drink too and stop. They're going to teach me how to take two and stop. That's what I thought. And then I learned that that's not really an option. That's not really what we do here anyway. So I was introduced to the 12 steps. Like Celeste found her own path to recovery. I found recovery through the 12 steps. A lot of people find recovery through the 12 steps. It's not the only way to recover, but it's the one that I know best. I've seen the most success with because that's what I do. So tonight we talked about dry drunk. And I was looking around the room and there's probably, I don't know, 30 patients in there. And a lot of them kind of like, what? I don't understand like what we're talking about. And it makes sense. The program of AA alludes to it several times, but it doesn't necessarily spell it out in the beginning. And I think people get confused. We are not trying to teach you how not to drink. That is not what we're after in AA. That's not what we're after in sobriety. It's not what it's really about. Alcohol, drugs, whatever your vice is about 5% of your problem. Mm-hmm. The other 95% lives in your mind. It lives in your ideas and your beliefs. That's what the problem is. It's not the substance. So you're real big on the behaviors, not the substance. And this is why. And AA would even agree with this. Alcohol is only mentioned one time in the steps, in step one.
In the steps, yeah. But throughout the book, it's talked about a lot.
A lot, right. But okay. Because it mentions alcoholism as a...
But I've heard before from people, and I'm just questioning this because I've heard before from people in recovery that they say AA is only there to keep you from stopping to drink. And that's why they don't address your marital problems or your behaviors.
That is not true at all. Okay. Absolutely not.
Okay.
No, AA does not teach you how not to drink. That's not what we're doing there. We are after emotional sobriety. True freedom from drinking is what Celeste describes, which is learning to regulate your emotions and deal with problems that previously triggered your drinking. That's what we're after. In order to do that, you got to dig deep beneath the surface. That's what an inventory is about. That's what it's really about. Mm-hmm. When you talk about marriage issues, now you're right. AA does not really discuss, here's how to fix a marriage. This is why TUFO exists, by the way, because no one really talks,
about
how to fix a marriage. And what they do say about it, I believe, it's my personal opinion, and I'm a fan of the program, but it's not perfect, is I think it's outdated information a lot of the times too.
Yeah, for sure.
So we modernized it.
That's why we modernized it, yes.
This has been our experience.
Because this is our way, and it worked out great. We have our Franken program.
Yeah, but no, that's not what we're after. I mean, alcohol is mentioned in one step, and everything after that is about behaviors, actions, ideas, intentions. It's about what are you doing about the stuff that's lying within you. Like, in AA, generally people go step one, step two, step three, and they disappear. Mm-hmm. Call it the three step. They come they work three steps, and they disappear because they get to step four, which is what we call the fearless and searching moral inventory. It's where you basically find out the why. Let's discover the why. No one wants to talk about the why. They just want to stop drinking. But if you don't discover the why, you've really accomplished nothing. Nothing. And that's what dry drunk is about. Mm-hmm. It's about not uncovering the things that cause this, or the behaviors that you take when you feel a certain way, or what you do with your emotions, or how you react rather than respond. And it leads to drinking. Alcohol is a symptom of a bigger problem. Absolutely. In my personal belief, that was my experience with it.
Yeah.
So dry drunk it's just that. It's someone that has removed the substance, but has done nothing to address the underlying behaviors that made them who they are in the first place, that made them resort to getting blitzed out of their mind anytime they felt uncomfortable. Let's deal with why you feel uncomfortable. Let's learn how to process that correctly. Then we can get, sober means nothing. Absolutely nothing.
But you do have to remove the substance in order to get to the underlying issues.
You're right. Okay, so I take it back. It means something, but very little.
I just want to make that clear. The
rest of this stuff. Right, right. Yeah, you're not going to be able to do this work while you're still drinking.
Yeah.
No, you have to remove that first, but all that does is set the stage for healing possible later down the line. That's all it does. It just clears the way to begin to clear the wreckage. It doesn't fix anything by itself. Sobriety is not enough. Just being sober means jack shit.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, but that makes it really complicated for a lot of spouses because they do focus on the substance a lot and say that because they think that that is what's causing the behaviors.
And that's rational too.
And absolutely, I agree with that. I know why it gets confusing. I really do. But the substances only amplify it. They're not the cause of the behaviors. Most of the time, the behaviors were there before they started using or drinking.
If y'all have ever wondered what a session is like with us, let's go down and let's kind of dig into it for a moment. So we hear that a lot, mm-hmm. is that it's like it's when they drink, they do these things. Let's back it up. Is that true? Let's go into your last fight when there was no alcohol involved. And someone will start to recount the fight. Well, we were late for the kid's soccer practice and he was really, really mean about it. And he was really ugly about it. And he was degrading and he was calling me names and he was mad at the kids and he was throwing stuff and he punched a hole in the wall. Sober. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's not just the substance, is it?
No.
No, the substance just makes it worse. It exacerbates the issue and it amplifies the issues that are already there. Mm-hmm. So it's not the truth to say that someone's wonderful when they're sober. I think a lot of people believe that, but that's not the truth.
Yeah.
Let's back it up. Let's really get into it. Like, were they ever really this person that you believe them to be in your mind?
Yeah.
Most of the time, that's not exactly the case.
The book by Lundy Bancroft, Why Does He Do That? Goes into this.
Yeah, it's really good too.
And discusses it. And I really do encourage a lot of people who are in these relationships to read that book. And we say it a lot, but I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, really, really, really good. Okay, so you just want to get into these questions? You want to discuss this a little bit more?
Yeah.
Hang on, before we do, what was your experience with me dry drunk? Talk about that story.
Which time? Okay, so no, whenever I was pregnant with our first, Matt decided to stop drinking with me.
We'd always had that deal.
We always had that deal. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal for me to stop drinking. It was fine. I was like, okay, this is whatever. I was totally cool. But around Christmas time, we, you know, there were a lot of family events and we were going to gatherings. And there was one in particular. We were sitting in front of that house and you were very irritated and you were
I was irritated
off.
The whole way there too.
Okay.
I remember having road rage. And just being mad at everything.
Barely remember that because you were just, that was part of your personality sometimes anyway. I mean, you know, it was kind of up and down. Like
you did that.
So whenever we got to the house, like, I was like, what's wrong with you? And you were just pissed. You were mad because you couldn't drink.
I said it. This
and
is the first time in my life I said it out loud.
And when you said that, I was like, like that. Like, shit. You serious? Yeah. And it pissed me off, honestly, because I was like, how fucking dare you? Like, suck it up, deal with it. I can't drink either. It's not a big deal. Let's just go have a good time. And you were just shitty, like in such a terrible mood. And I was like, wow, he's not even drinking. He's being more of an asshole now than he was before.
Did it occur to you in that moment that there was a problem?
Probably like in the back of my mind, but I didn't want to address it. There's no way I wanted to address it. I was pregnant.
That was the first time I ever admitted that I had a problem.
With alcohol, you've talked about being messed up, having a problem with pills before.
Yeah, I have.
And there was another time in our,
apartment.
Yes, we were about 19 years old.
Yep. I admitted to you then I had a problem with it.
And
but
I
had it
but
under control.
I didn't know exactly. But see, we were so young that I was like, I didn't know anything.
Neither of us understood addiction.
You would think it was a red flag.
No.
I mean, there were so many red flags, which we discuss in our course. I'm still talking. Quit trying to interrupt me.
What is your deal? Oh my gosh, I'm sorry.
I'm on fire.
I'm sorry.
No, I see your face and I was just trying to talk to you about face. Okay, if y'all aren't watching us on YouTube, you should watch us on YouTube because his face is hilarious.
Sorry.
But yes, we did not know much about addiction back then. So it was still one of those like, put it under the rug, everything's going to be fine. I didn't think anything of it. And we do discuss that in the course on how we went through all of the different stages of the red flags. But yeah, that was my experience with the dry drunk early on. But there were even more behaviors later on into sobriety. I mean, even early in sobriety that you still had to deal with.
Yeah. And many people have no clue what they're up against. Like when they have these moments, you might relate to this and have a recollection of a time like this in your own life where, man, I've been there before. Like I've been there where I wasn't drinking, wanted to support my wife when she was pregnant. And it was tougher than I thought it would be. It was the first time in my life that I admitted that I was upset that I couldn't drink and I was struggling with not drinking. And it scared me. And I said it out loud and I don't even know where that honesty came from because I wasn't really an honest person at the time of my life. But it scared me. I had no idea about the disease of the mind. I had no idea about the mental obsession. I had no idea about the allergy that kicks in whenever I have a drink or I have a pill. And it's just like that more thing that starts in my brain.
Yeah.
We didn't know about any of that. I think most people approach drinking like they would any other problem where it's like, okay, you're tired of slipping on a banana peel. Just freaking move the banana peels, dude. Throw them in the trash can. Problem solved. That's easy. Mm-hmm. You know, you clap your hands. We're done.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
But many people approach it that way. Yeah. And I think that a lot of spouses, this is where I'd like to get into this bucket called sobriety. That's what, I can't take credit for that. Someone said this to me. I don't mention who they are, but it's a really good way to put it, I think. A bucket called sobriety. There are so many behaviors that our partners, spouses, friends, mothers, fathers, whoever, have a drinking problem or a drug problem that we throw into this bucket called sobriety. And it's the substance. And the bucket on the outside of this bucket, it says beer or wine or pills or Coke or meth or whatever. And it's emotional unavailability. It's short temper. It's the inability to get up on time.
Lies.
It's not able to hold a job. Mm-hmm. It's lying, gaslighting, deflecting, projecting, denying, all the behaviors that you see in this person that are throwing up your red flags. Like, man, this is just not right. This person ain't right. We throw it in a bucket called sobriety. And it's like, that's the problem. It's that they're not sober. So if we can just remove the substance, they're all sober, and we're fixed. Too. And that is so rational and logical. I know why people go there.
Absolutely. I do too.
Makes perfect sense,
it
right?
It does, for sure.
I've identified the problem. Let's remove the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Without it's understanding that the bucket's called brain. The bucket's called behaviors. The bucket's called ideas. The bucket's called, this is who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
This is me. That mm-hmm. bucket has their name on it. This is a bucket of Brian. I don't know who Brian is. If you're listening, I'm sorry.
Brian.
I just picked a name. This bucket is Brian, and these things are in him. They are not separate from the substance. If the substance does anything at all, it just makes these things worse. Mm-hmm. But they exist even in the absence of the substance. That's been my experience, and that was our experience.
Absolutely.
And I've never seen this not be true. And many people experience it too, which is why this episode exists.
Exactly.
So that's what it's really about. It's these ideas that we have that these things are related to the substance, and it's not just the substance. So then it makes sense also that if you remove the substance, what happens? The behaviors don't go anywhere. They don't change. They don't do anything. And as long as they remain unaddressed, they're going to sit there and stew and sometimes get worse than they would otherwise.
Yeah. And I think it's easier for me to look at it from not the substance way, because then I'm like, okay, this person is treating me a certain way that is affecting me, and that's easier to deal with than the actual substance. Because whenever you blame the substance, it makes it more difficult, because we almost have too much education when it comes to alcoholism and addictive thinking and all that, that people start to use it as an excuse. When I look at it as like, I don't care if you're drinking or not. I don't care if you're using drugs or not. What you're doing is affecting me. And that's where the boundaries are going to be set. And if they are crossed, there will be consequences.
Yeah, this is sort of whenever we get into like this a topic of abuse.
Exactly.
Where people are really uncomfortable using that word, that term abuse.
And like, I don't blame you, because I didn't like it when you used that term.
Yeah, I'm not abusive. Because we think of abuse as physical. Like, he doesn't hit me. You can be just as abusive and more damaging in some ways by not touching anybody. You can abuse people with your
betrayal,
with your tongue, with your mouth, with the things that come out of your mouth, mm-hmm. the things you say, the actions you take, blocking someone from leaving a room as you're berating them and screaming at them or throwing things or, you know, tossing all their stuff out. Like, that is abusive.
Yeah.
That's abusive. And that stuff is there in the absence of a substance. These things remain. This is what dry drunk is all about.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, this is what we're after in sobriety. This is what it encompasses. It's not just a removal of the substance. It's addressing the underlying behaviors, ideas that exist.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to just explore today. I wanted to read something real quick. And the book actually addresses this. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous is sort of like our Bible, I guess you could call it, for lack of a better term. We actually read this tonight. So there's a chapter called Into Action. It talks about how to put the stuff into action, of course. So it says, the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" It's a 1930s reference, but I think it's perfect.
Oh, I agree.
So on point.
Yes.
They knew this in 1939. Why this isn't more discussed, I don't know. I don't know why this isn't just common knowledge, but I hope that after this episode that people have more clarity on it.
Agreed.
That this is absolutely a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people get really mad at the term dry drunk.
Oh, yeah.
Because it sounds degrading, and it kind of is, but it's not.
But we use the word alcoholic and addict, and a lot of people don't like using that these days. So we kind of go against the grain. Story of our life.
Not real big on getting my feelings hurt over labels.
No.
You know. But yeah, they say it here, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. Selfish and inconsiderate habit. It doesn't say the drinking. At no point in that did I say the 10th beer, the 7th beer, or the Coke after the beer. That's what did it. No, it's the lack of affection. It's a lack of investment in a relationship. It's selfish and inconsiderate habits.
But there are programs that blame the alcohol for the behavior.
There are. And that's not what we do here.
Yeah.
That's not what we do here.
It just confuses me sometimes when I read that and then I hear it from elsewhere and I'm like, okay, no wonder people are so confused with what's going on right now.
Man, that's a totally different, I don't want to get into it again.
I wasn't going to get into it. It just made me think of that because it's from the same.
There is an answer for that. There is an answer for that, for how to manage someone in active addiction.
Yes.
And that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. To go there.
All right. Well, let's go down the questions.
Let's run it.
You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
All right.
So let me ask first when you answer. You answer.
You're really going to start shifting things on me today with my attitude?
Yes.
You're asking for it, buddy.
All right. Question one. Does dry drunk make them less emotionally available?
Okay. Less emotionally available from when they're drunk or just from somebody in recovery? I mean, it's...
Go both.
Okay, so it's going to be pretty similar to somebody in active addiction, I would think.
Yeah, dry drunk is just like someone in active addiction, just minus the substance. So they're absolutely less emotionally available than a recovered person. Now, alcohol is used, drugs are used as anesthetics. I was very lovey-dovey when I was high.
Yes, you were.
Very lovey-dovey, mm-hmm. because that was the only way I could access part of me. Like I couldn't get there on my own. I didn't have the skills to do it. I didn't know how to sit with my feelings and show affection. I could only do it when I was so high that like I had no other problems and I could look at you and be like, oh, I want to love on you right now. And it was always cringe, you know, real cringe.
It was like the highs and highs and lows, lows. Like there, it was, yeah, it was cringy.
So drunks can be like, you might think it's emotionally available, but it's not.
But it's not.
First of all, they're not going to remember the conversations you just had.
No. And
they're not doing this from a place of like genuine, like, I see you. I understand your experience. I'm here for you. It's just drunk shit.
So dry drunk, you're going to be even... less emotionally available than you're when you're drunk
more of a pain in the ass, more terse, more coarse whenever you're
because you're not drunk. Getting that dopamine that's going to kick up that emotion.
I don't have the skills to access that part of my brain. I don't know what it's like to really be emotionally connected to anybody.
Not yet.
Think about when guys get drunk, right? Like as men, like we don't have emotions. We have plenty of emotions, right? But as men, we're taught not to have them when we're young. A lot of boys are.
Yeah.
And when we get drunk, man, I love you so much. Everyone knows that guy, right?
Yeah.
Like that guy who gets drunk and he starts getting all teary-eyed. When that guy's sober, what's he like? Never. You never hear him talk like that. Mm-hmm. You never hear that kind of stuff come out of his mouth. That's the only way we're comfortable accessing those parts of us is when our inhibitions are lower to a point where we feel like we can go there. So when you're you're sober, you don't. You don't go there. You're less emotionally available.
I just had a thought. You know how we went to that wedding last weekend?
Yep.
And at the reception, everyone was having a great time. And you were actually dancing and having an amazing time that no one would think that you were sober.
As I was dancing to
you were dancing with another guy too.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, but man, we two stepped.
I need to post that because it's so adorable.
It was
an
great.
Old friend.
I love him so much.
Oh my gosh, such a sweetheart. And y'all looked so cute together.
We were a great couple.
But people would not know that you were sober. And I think that took you a few years to get to that point. You were not always like that.
Do you
at
remember
parties.
The Halloween party that I won the costume contest when I dressed up as Ted?
That was the first time I ever recognized you doing that.
And that was, I was probably a year or two sober then.
Yes, because MJ, I was pregnant with MJ.
So it took about a year or two for me to get there.
Yeah.
Early on, I did not have, I no, And this was 2 years of intensive work before I was comfortable.
And even then it was like, it was still gradual. Like it wasn't at every event. Sometimes it was like, eh, I don't really want to be here. And this is not, you know,
I was uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now like you would think that I'm the drunk guy at the party.
Yes.
But I'm not.
No.
I have nothing in
there. No. I don't know. That just hit me. That's pretty cool.
I think that's, it's a good dimension because I think that gives people hope. Mm-hmm. I think that should give people hope.
Yeah.
That like
you can still have fun.
Oh my God. The most
a blast.
Fun.
Yes. And you remember it.
Every bit.
Like we were dancing with our kids. Like we had such a good time. All right. You want me to go to the next question? Or
yeah.
Are you going to say it?
Are we done there?
I believe so.
Emotional availability.
Yeah.
Think back to your experience with me for a moment when I was like that Christmas party where I was dry mm-hmm. drunk. Mm-hmm. What was I like? You remember?
I didn't want to be around you.
I did not want, I did. Exactly.
But I was also walking on eggshells and I was also wondering like, what can I do to make him feel better? That was another thing.
I remember you were really concerned about me mm-hmm. and you were like, it's okay if you want to have a drink. And at this point I was like mad at myself and I was like, no, I'm going to gut this out. I'm stronger than this. I can do this. But I was freaking miserable. I remember sitting on the fireplace with your cousin and this is when your uncle's still alive. God bless him. He's freaking mm-hmm. amazing. Such a great person. But I remember being there and just like everyone happy and they're having a good time. I remember just being like, why can't I just be happy like these people? Like why am I not like them? Like, why can I not just enjoy myself?
Well, they were all drinking too.
But I wanted to be able to do that and not be trashed.
Yeah.
Like I know people do that. Why couldn't I? I was so mad at myself.
That's right, because you couldn't like drink. You had to be effed up whenever you were drinking or using or whatnot. Like you couldn't have just two drinks and be okay.
I had to be buzzed.
You had to be really messed up. Yeah, but I just remember because you know me being an empath, I would always take on your emotions, so I would feel like walking on eggshells around you at that party, and I was like, this is really uncomfortable.
And that's just
because I wanted
instance.
You to be happy. I was like, why couldn't you just be happy and just normal? But that just goes to show that you have to work through it and change your behaviors and habits.
That's the difference between an alcoholic or an addict brain and someone with a normal brain.
My name's not normal. I mean, my brain's not normal. Far from it, but that's okay. Everyone just heard me lose my shit earlier, so.
All right.
Next. Okay. The next one is, what is the rate of relapse for a dry drunk? I did read that somewhere it said that if you do start seeing dry drunk behaviors, then these people may relapse soon. But there are some people who don't relapse at all, but they're still having the same behavior for 20 plus years. So that's, I don't think that that's a good indicator to think that somebody's going to relapse. Is it or is it not?
Relapse is high regardless. Like relapse rates are pretty high regardless.
Yeah.
There hasn't, and I read up on this, there hasn't been an actual study for, there's one and it kind of alludes to some conclusions about this, but there's nothing that's really been done. Like answer this question, what's the rate of relapse for a dry drunk? It's nuanced, right? So most people that recover don't do it through a 12-step program or therapy or smart recovery or anything like that. They just stop. So are those people dry drunks? It's a quantitative study. So it's a number of the measure of the amount of people that recovered over a certain period of time. It's not a qualitative study. That's what I'd be interested in seeing. What's the quality of the recovery?
The recovery.
How do they rate their happiness levels? How do they rate their relationship intimacy? How do they rate their satisfaction with their job or their kids or whatever? Things like that are, I think, how you would really obtain, like, look, they're sober, but are they dry drunk? I don't believe that everyone who stopped drinking is a dry drunk. I don't think that that's necessarily true, but I know that there are a lot of them who are.
Yes.
Because I hear stories all the time from people. It's like, you know, my grandfather quit drinking. He just one day just stopped. I'm like, what was he like? He was a grumpy ass old man. I mean, no one ever talked to him. He was mean as shit. Mm-hmm. You know, he's meaner than a rattlesnake. Okay. This guy's probably a dry drunk. I don't have any way of like proving that, but there are a lot of stories like that. How many people just successfully stopped drinking, internally did their own work and got happy like Celeste? Mm-hmm. Far fewer, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But rates of relapse are high, period. And the reason is, when you start to feel life again, when you start to feel these emotions that trigger drinking at one time, it's really hard not to take that easy medicine to go back to happiness and bliss. It's really hard not to. Far fewer people will actually address, why do I feel this way? Damn it, I don't want to feel this way. Furthermore, what could I do to not feel this way anymore? So few people are willing to go that far to say, how can I develop a skill to get me out of this? They're just going to do the easy thing, which is to get drunk.
Right.
Or take the pill.
Yeah.
Or snort it or shoot it or whatever you do, whatever it is, you know, that you do. But to truly seek emotional sobriety is rare, period, I would say.
I agree.
It's just rare.
I agree.
That's what AA does. That's what a lot of sobriety programs teach. That's what they're ultimately after. But how many people stick around them? The rates aren't exactly clear. Like in AA, it's an anonymous program, right? But my experience has been about 5% of people stick around for a year. But then the rates of relapse decrease substantially over that time. Like after 5 years, the amount of people that relapse, it's like 13% or maybe it's 20%, something less. It's like far fewer than normal. It goes from, you know, 95% or 80% to like 10%.
Well, then, just goes to show you how long recovery takes too.
Yeah. And then after like 10 years, the amount of people that relapse, it's like single digits.
Yeah.
It's like 7% or something like that. I could be a little wrong on these numbers, but it's very low. It's very, very low compared to people early on. Early sobriety is tough. A lot of people relapse. Most people relapse. Yeah. I relapsed many times before I finally got it.
Well, before you went to treatment.
Before I went to treatment, before I went to AA.
But when you were doing it on your own.
Yeah, I'm going to figure this out on my own, man. We all are. No, man, just like there are people who have figured it out before. Just ask what they did and do what they did. I'm telling you, like that's a life hack for you if you're struggling. Just find someone that figured it out. They're happy and they're free. Like find someone who's free. Mm-hmm. Like Steve, we've had on the show, tells this beautiful story about how life changed for him on his second day sober. His first day sober, someone said, you need to go to a meeting. He went to a meeting. He was there. He was present, right? But day two, his life changed forever. He looked across the room and he heard a guy who was telling his story. Like this guy was speaking his truth. And he looked in the guy's eyes. He goes, I could see it, dude. He was free.
Yeah.
He was free. It had been removed. He was happy and he was free. He had found a way out and I hadn't. And then he had these crazy thoughts. What would my life look like if this could actually work? And then why not me? And he got hopeful. But that's what we're after. It's that freedom.
Yeah.
Not just the removal of the substance, not just the bucket called sobriety.
All right. The next one is how to handle the terminal uniqueness of AA won't work for me. And they rely on me, which is the spouse, for his support system.
You go first.
Are you sure? Because we talked about this earlier and you were
testy. I want to see how it goes. It comes out this time.
No, you were testy. Okay. Whatever. Okay. Well, first of all, like, Somebody wanting to rely on their spouse as their support system, like basically as their sponsor, is not going to work. Yes, you can be there as support, which is just being by their side, listening to them, you know, telling them you're proud of them for what they're doing, but it's not actually, they don't need to be relying on you to keep them sober. That is not what anybody should be doing in a marriage. That was not our case. And I don't think I would want that job. I don't think that we would have been able to handle that. And what do you have to say about the terminal uniqueness of AA won't work for me?
Well, to piggyback off what you just said, think about this. What are most of these men complaining about? Like, you're not my mother. Like, and you don't want to be their mother either.
Oh my God, that's so true.
So what are you doing with this where you want me to parent you and then you want to freak out on me when I try?
Yeah.
So
damned if you don't.
And this is a great question. How do you handle that? How do you handle this terminal uniqueness saying that won't work for me? That's just not for me. You know how many times I've heard that?
Oh, this is, we hear this every single day.
Dude, AA wasn't for me either.
Every day.
It wasn't for me either, right? But it works if you do it. I don't care.
Exactly.
Just do it, right? So this is not a spouse's role. And here's why. If you haven't gotten sober before, you don't have the experience of what it's like to deal with those emotions. You don't have an addicted brain. You don't know what it's like to fight those urges. Mm-mm. You don't know what it's like to deal with the triggers. You don't know what it's like to develop the skills. Why are you asking someone who's not an expert to be an expert? That's what it really boils down to. So you could say to someone who's asking you to do this, say, honey, I don't think that I'm equipped for this. I don't struggle with what you struggle with, and I empathize with you, but I'm not the person who's best suited to deal with this. There are people who do this. There are groups everywhere and people who will help you for free.
Yeah.
If you just ask for their help. And I will support you in your sobriety, but I will not be your sponsor.
Yeah. And you know, when people say like, you know, AA won't work for me, that's just like kind of like saying like, oh, exercise won't work for me. Eating healthy won't work for me. You know, reading won't work for me. Going to school won't work for me. Like all these things. It's like, it'll work if you work it. You have to find, you have to do something different because the way that you're doing it isn't working right now. But as a spouse, it's really hard to watch somebody and then somebody, you know, you can try to talk them into, you know, doing a program, but that doesn't really work either. It's about your values too.
Like, I don't get anything for talking of like, for like, we don't get money for recruiting people to AA. Like, it's not an MLM, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
All I do is I cast a wide net of hope and I hope that it resonates with one person and they can hear that I'm genuine, I'm sincere, I'm authentic in my story, my experience with it. And they could just have that magical thought, why not me? Well, if it worked for that idiot, why couldn't it work for me?
Yeah, but there's also other programs you can look into. There are solutions.
There are options. There are solutions. Absolutely.
There are things out there that you can look into.
Yeah. I'm an advocate of AA because that's how I found freedom.
Right.
But I've since read about many other ways to do it. And it's not the only way to do
it.
I concede that. But it is the most available that's out there. Like there's, you can find it.
Oh yeah. It's anywhere.
Wherever you are.
Right, right.
It's easy to get to. And you're going to find people in there who have achieved emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
It's possible, guys. It's possible. It works if you work it. And that is so true. It's like exercise. You mentioned that there are people who can't lose weight and they've tried everything or they say they have anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, well, if you would just eat these foods right here, these foods and exercise, doing these exercises, for this amount of time, you will get exactly what you want. Mm-hmm. And they'll look at that and say, that won't work for
me. That's not going to work for me.
Okay. So what makes you different? That's my question. Always. What makes you different? Let's hear it. Tell me how unique you are. I can't wait.
You love that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I just get giddy. I'm like, I can't wait to hear how special you are. And they tell me, I'm like, okay, yeah, I had all the same concerns, man. Just cast them aside and trust that it works if you do the work.
Yeah.
It's not for people that need it. It's people that want it.
That right there.
So you have to want it.
Yep.
Or nothing will work.
Yeah.
You will find some reason that everything won't work.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's tough. And I get it. Listen, I've been there before.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. Is a dry drunk as far removed from recovery as when actively drinking?
I think arguably you could say that they're even further removed. I think that when you're drinking, we talked about alcohol and drugs being an anesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. Now there is a limit to this too, where you can be so lost in the unmanageability of an addiction, like where I was taking 50, 60 pills a day. That is worse than dry drunk, right? Like there's a limit, but there are also people who consider themselves almost like gray area drinkers. Like I'm an alcoholic, maybe I'm a heavy drinker for sure. Like, am I really a drinker? Who drink, let's say it's six beers every night and it's just six beers every night, but they have to have six beers. If they don't get six beers, they're miserable. They can stop drinking to prove a point to their spouse that, listen, I did exactly what you asked. I'm fine. And then they can shift into that selfish mindset, that egotistical mindset that I know what's best. I was right after all. She's an idiot. She doesn't know what she's talking about. And then you're not consumed by alcohol anymore. You're consumed by this self-centeredness and this egotistical perspective that is almost, it's like a narcissistic perspective.
Yep.
And is that more damaging? I think you could make an argument for that,
mm-hmm.
where someone could get further removed when they're dry.
Yeah.
Like when you're drinking, sometimes people are reasonable. I'm not saying that they're going to remember these conversations, but they're more approachable.
Mm-hmm.
When someone's like dug in on their ego and then this narcissistic type of behavior, arguably more, they're more removed.
Yeah.
Like I know people that have been in the program before. I've known people when they were using, I've known them when they've been in the program, and I've known them when they've gotten out and they're dry. And like dry is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
It's the worst because... Uh-huh. They have knowledge now that
yep.
I know it. I know. Yeah, I know. People that say that, man, no, you don't. You don't.
Mm-mm.
But if you can convince yourself that you know a solution, you figured it out and you're a genius, that's dangerous. People that think they found a solution and they haven't is freaking dangerous.
Yeah.
That's like when the narcissism stuff kicks over.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
So true. Oh, that was solid. I don't have anything to add to that one. Can or how do you communicate better with a dry drunk? So can you communicate better with a dry drunk? And if so, how? It's very similar to communicating with somebody who is in active addiction. The only difference here is that if you're going to have a conversation with this person and they're still having the behaviors, they may say, well, I'm not drunk anymore. I'm not drinking.
Once again,
I'm
possibly
fine.
More difficult.
Yeah, more difficult because you don't, you've taken away their substance, but they're still communicating the way that they were in active addiction.
I've got a tip here.
Okay.
So we talked about the bucket called sobriety.
Yep.
I think that for so long, spouses are asking to stop drinking. And they're wearing people's ass out about the drinking. Oh, you bought beer again. You bought, you know, 99 bananas or Fireball or whatever crap people drink these days. I don't know.
Is that bananas?
99 bananas. You haven't seen that one?
No.
That's a popular one.
Okay.
It's like Fireball banana flavored. Ooh, it's like a liqueur, I think.
Gag. That's disgusting.
I haven't tried it, but I've heard it tastes like banana Laffy Taffy.
Okay, yeah. Well, I like banana Laffy Taffy.
That stuff's fire.
Yeah,
banana
I agree.
Laffy Taffy's the best Laffy Taffy. Fight me. Everyone agreed. Knows that. Green's the second. The green apples. What, you like grape or something, weirdo?
No, I just like the banana. I don't like the other ones.
You don't like the strawberry one either?
I think there's cherry. Is there cherry?
There's a strawberry for sure. I mean, there could be a cherry.
Strawberry's okay. Banana's the best.
What was the question?
Okay. You had a tip on how to communicate better.
Okay. So we talked about the bucket called sobriety, right?
Yeah.
For so long, people have begged and begged and begged and begged for sobriety with not really realizing what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to frame what you're actually asking for. And we've talked about some of this in our past episodes. I don't remember the names of them now. There's been a few. But to have a conversation, and this is helpful in any conversation, right? If you can own your part in a disagreement, it's really helpful to disarm other people. Mm-hmm. So you can have a conversation. You pick the moment, but it's got to be the right moment where they're not irate or angry. You don't do it in the middle of an argument, right? Say, I've been asking you to stop drinking, and I didn't realize I was asking for the wrong thing. I thought for so long that it was the alcohol, but it's so much more than that. It's that I feel like you're an unavailable partner to me sometimes. I feel like you don't support me and help me around the home with the kids, that I'm alone on an island sometimes. I feel like you're not available to me like we had talked about when we first got together. And those are the things I'm missing. That's what I'm after. So when I was saying sobriety, I was asking for the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the most effective way to communicate with this person about what's really the problem. Like what are you really actually seeing that is causing a problem in the relationship? Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's the behaviors. So address the behaviors.
Yes.
And not so much just their behaviors, but
how it's affecting you.
Right. What is mm-hmm. the effect of that behavior on the relationship, on the family unit, even on them?
Yeah.
Like when I said you need to get sober, I thought that you would start getting up on time and holding a job for more than a month or two.
Or you would be happier. Yeah, you know?
That you would want to spend time with us at, you know, the fair or whatever we do. Like that's the stuff I'm hurting on right now. And I think that it's deeper than sobriety. You know, I heard Tufo talking about it. And they mentioned it. You should check out the episode. Listen to it together. The guy on there is just like him.
Oh, yeah. That was solid.
I think that's what I would.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%. All right. So, what behaviors come with dry drunk? We've kind of touched on this on already.
Yeah, we've talked about it. We'll just kind of touch on this again. Again, like Celeste did, I think, the best job at describing this. But behaviors that triggered drinking previously. What caused the drinking behaviors previously? So, is it work stress? Okay, so if they're not drinking, then it's going to be just amplified work stress. Mm-hmm. It's discomfort. It's abusive type behaviors. It's narcissistic type behaviors.
Yes.
It's gaslighting, projecting. You're the problem, not me. I can't be the problem.
Outbursts.
When you're the problem. Yeah, tantrums, punching holes in walls.
Not having like productive conversations.
Yeah.
Like it'll go in circles.
Absolutely.
Just like it was an active addiction.
Yeah. It feels like you're in a relationship with a very emotionally immature person.
That right there.
That's really what it's about. Mm-hmm. So those are the behaviors that come with it. And people know it when they're in it. And we see this from a lot of wheelies where they'll come in and be like, he's been sober sometimes it can be quite some time, but most of the time it's pretty early on. It's like 4 to 6 months or 8 months. It's like, I thought things would be getting better, but nothing's better. Like he's still the same person. If they're still the same person they were, that's a great sign. And they're not working a program. That's always a common denominator. Mm-hmm. I don't see this with people who are really dedicated to getting better.
Right. There are still going to be parts, obviously, but there's progress.
There's progress.
There's progress in different parts of their area, different parts of the behaviors.
Did we have a question about that before we just... diverge on that real quick?
I don't know. I think that we were going to talk about more of it down here, maybe.
Okay, well, let's come back to that about the thing we talked about on my way home today.
Yeah.
About when to invest, when to go. I think that someone had to ask that question.
Okay. All right, you want me to go to the next question?
Yeah.
All right. Communicating with love that we are proud they are sober, but there are still behaviors that need to be addressed. That's pretty much what you just discussed.
It's back to how to have
the conversation. You can be proud that somebody's sober. I mean, that's an achievement in itself, but it's time to switch it to how the behaviors are affecting you.
Two things can be true at the same time.
Yep.
You can be very, very proud of someone's efforts to get sober. Listen, it's not easy to get sober, even if you're dry. It is not easy to get sober. You can let them know, like, I see that, and that is a commitment, and I appreciate that. I didn't realize I was asking for the wrong thing, and I wasn't aware. It's okay to admit that I was wrong about this. I didn't know that it's so much deeper than that for you. I didn't realize that you weren't raised with good examples and that you never learned how to process emotions. I never realized that you weren't taught to be emotional. I didn't realize any of these things. That's the stuff that hurts.
Yeah. And I think that, and I may be off base here, but I think that a lot of spouses, when this starts to happen, there might be a little guilt feeling here because they may feel like, oh my gosh, all I asked for was for them to be sober. Now they are, and I'm not happy. And they might feel guilty for that because, you know, we're very emotional people. And I'm going to tell you now, you can let go of that guilt because you don't know any different. It's so common to put that substance with the behaviors.
Likewise, I felt guilt when I went through this too, because mm-hmm. I believed the same thing and I felt guilt. Mm-hmm. I felt guilt that this was going to fix our problems, that I was going to be the man that I truly wanted to be. I wanted to be that guy. I wanted to be the guy I watched on, like, in The Notebook. What was his name, the character?
I can't
remember. I wanted to be
Ryan Gosling is his real name.
Right.
Noah!
Noah. I wanted to be him, you know, but I couldn't. And I had the same level of guilt.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shocking realization, too, where you go, oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got bigger problems, huh? Mm-hmm,
for sure.
It's like, oh, God, this is way worse than we thought. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, you're right. There's some guilt associated with that.
Yeah.
You don't know what you don't know. It's okay.
All right. I like this question. Are they self-aware? Do they see their blame shifting, manipulation, etc.? No. It's kind of like what you said earlier with people who have been through programs and then they come out and then they're like, they think they know it all, but they're still not working it. And they're back to where they were at square one. And they're not self-aware of who they are. Those who have narcissistic traits are typically not self-aware.
Typically, yeah, you're right. Absolutely right.
So
we've talked a lot about alcoholism and addiction and how these people present themselves very similar to narcissists and how the abuse feels exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same. Now, there's a difference between being a self-aware asshole and being a non-self-aware asshole.
That's true.
I think every couple can have a fight at some point where you're just like, you know, when you just get fed up mm-hmm. and you're like, all right, I got time. Let's argue. And like, you're just going to argue. And like, you, even with, what are you pointing at me? I'm thinking about you. So you just want to argue.
Where's my self-awareness?
Narc. And so people, we can do that at times where it's like, I'm dug in on this and I know I'm going to have to apologize for it later. And you know that in the back of your mind, but it's like, let's go. I'm arguing. You know what I'm talking about? You ever done this?
No.
You've never once argued with me to like argue about something dumb.
No, I try to prove my point is right.
That's what I'm talking about.
But I'm not doing it and then going to apologize later.
When you're wrong?
Well, like, do you do it knowing that it's wrong and then you're going to apologize for it later?
At some point in an argument, I can realize that I've lost. And it's almost like debate at that point. It's like,
okay, this is interesting.
How can I reframe this and like prove, because ego gets involved. Right?
You've always done that. That's why you should have been a lawyer.
And it's like, now I have to get tricky about things so I can be correct about something. And that's self-aware, but what dry drunk.
That's manipulation.
That is manipulation.
Yeah, I. Mm-mm.
Yeah, that's manipulation.
Now, I'll know if I'll do wrong later, but I'm not doing it in the moment knowing that I'm doing wrong.
How did a nice girl like you get caught up with a guy like
me. I've actually had like sessions with my therapist over this years ago because like we were talking about, you know, me crying used to be like a trigger for you. And I was like, I'm not manipulating him, but he feels like I'm manipulating him. And she said, I know you're not manipulating him. I know that you're, because she knew me and she's like, you're crying to cry. But she said, there are some people who do cry to manipulate the situation.
They're out there.
I was not doing that. It was literally like, I'm really hurt right now and I'm crying. So were you projecting in a way?
No, like what I'm talking about is like just reaching further and further for an argument.
I know what you're talking about. You know what I mean? I get it, but okay.
Like you start with like the whataboutisms. Like what about the time 3 weeks ago when you did this? And it's like, you're just trying to freaking argue now. Like you're not even really, like you're wrong.
Okay. I understand that. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. Okay. Totally makes sense. I get it. Great conversation.
Everyone does
babe.
That, right?
Like, oh yeah, for sure.
That kind of crap.
Oh, for sure. Like, for sure.
My ego is involved now and I'm just going to find an angle where I can, it's like,
no,
I can prove
no,
you
No,
now
I'm pissed and I just need to like bring something up that's going to like.
Basically. Yeah, right. Okay, but are people self-aware? When someone's dry drunk, if someone's a narcissist, no, they are generally not self-aware about these things. They feel justified and they feel right in their anger. Mm-hmm. They feel right in their explanations and their defense of themselves. They're generally not in a sane mind. Like you're not dealing with someone who's rationally thinking about the problem. Mm-hmm. They're just not. They don't have the tools for that. They're not developed enough to argue to reach a healthy conclusion. It's about right or wrong. If you've never read a story I wrote called Drop the Rope, yep. based on Jesse and Jay Norman's concept mm-hmm. on Moving On Again podcast, which they're amazing people. If you haven't checked out that podcast, so you'd love probably them. Love it too. If you've got a blended family, check out that podcast.
Yes.
Really great. But yeah, that's what it's about. And that's what Drop the Rope's about. These people don't have the tool for that. They haven't developed that skill. It's a skill you develop in a marriage to drop a rope, you know, but there are people, especially like narcissistic types and people who are in active addiction or even dry drunk that they're so far from even understanding that there's a problem within them. They just like, you're wrong and I'm right. And that's as far as I'll ever take it. Mm-hmm. The other people that they've been hurt and other people are responsible. That's as far as they've ever taken it.
Yeah.
Without ever looking at the part in things or how ridiculous this sounds or how absurd the claim is. Mm-hmm. They're not self-aware most of the time. Yeah. No. People aren't that smart about it. Very few people are that conniving and that smart. Like you give us too much credit.
Yeah.
Just not self-aware.
Oh, like, not it's just an ego thing. It's just for you to make sure that you're winning and you're not going to get hurt. It's a it's a protection mechanism, I think.
Yeah.
It's to protect themselves from getting harmed.
Right.
Okay. All right. What can you say when a dry drunk feels they don't need help? Okay. We already said that one earlier.
We're on top of it, y'all.
Yes. There was a lot of questions. Sorry. What is the brain science? What causes the behaviors once the substance is gone? And do the behaviors have to be reprogrammed? Read Addictive Thinking. When it comes great to book. The when it comes to the brain
Abraham
science.
J. Tversky.
Because it does kind of talk about how the brain works with these thoughts.
And yeah. An even better book than that. It's right over here, I think. What is it? Oh, my God. It's called Biology of Desire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Biology yes. of Desire. Yes. That one's good, too.
Really, really good. Talks about literally like the neuro. It is full, packed full of neuroscience. And I'm nowhere near I'm very interested in neuroscience. Mm-hmm. I'm nowhere near qualified enough to like really, I'm like, I'm not Andrew Huberman. I cannot explain this as well as some people can.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the construction paper and crayons version of this as I understand it.
Okay.
Okay. So there's nurture versus nature. Okay. So there are things that we all have. Like there's a genetic component to addiction. Mm-hmm. Propensity to addiction. Your environment generally unlocks it, right? Just because you have the gene does not mean you're guaranteed to display the gene. And this is true of anything. Like you can even have a gene for a certain cancer, but it may not be present or shown until your environment, your whatever you put in your body, whether it's smoking or whatever else, unlocks this thing.
Right.
So there's a component of this that is purely genetic. Some people are born with propensities to be a certain way, whatever it might be, right? Behavioral, personality types, things like that. But when the substance is involved, it changes the mind, changes the chemistry of the mind, changes the biology of the mind. It physically alters the mind, which is why we call addiction a disease. It is not a disease like you think it's a disease. It's not, right? We call it a disease because anytime a system of the body has physically changed and altered, it is diseased.
Mm-hmm.
If your pancreas doesn't work right, you've got diabetes. It is disease of the pancreas. If you have heart disease, your heart is physically different in form. It is diseased.
Okay.
The brain, addiction, same way.
Right.
So when the behaviors are present in active addiction, there's a process called neuroplasticity. It's the process by which the brain learns
habits.
Habits, basically.
Right.
You okay?
Yeah. I gotta pee.
I can tell. You need to peel away. Go for it. Let me just sit here and just explain this real quick.
No, it's good.
Okay.
You'll talk this whole podcast.
Okay, so I'm going to take a moment now.
I hate you. Now you're just being a dick.
Okay, long story short, construction paper version is that you have behaviors that you learn through nurture. Your parents teach you certain things, your environment, the way you were raised, the place that you were raised, the socioeconomic status that you were when you were younger, factor into the beliefs and ideas you have about how to treat other people generally. Your value system, were you raised in a church, were you raised as a heathen in the woods, these things all matter, right? So addiction, once again, changes these things. So some of these behaviors were always there, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Some of these things were always there. Even in the absence of addiction, they were always there, which is, once again, we have to look at the behaviors. Now, neuroplasticity is a beautiful process. The same process by which we learn bad things, we can learn good things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not lost. So you can absolutely reprogram the mind.
Absolutely.
You can reprogram the mind. I have reprogrammed my mind. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this. I don't know if I'm a recovered narcissist who had a drinking problem and pill problem, or if I'm a recovered drug addict that had narcissistic type behaviors.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I wish I would have like really seen a psych at one point long before this ever started. Because I don't know.
I don't think empathy, you're a narcissist because you had empathy when I first met you.
Yeah, empathy is the like defining characteristic that a narcissist does not have.
Yes.
They don't feel bad for the things they do generally. And it's a spectrum and there are different levels of this. But
do you feel
like,
bad for the things that you do?
Absolutely.
I feel like your empathy level has just like skyrocketed to where you can actually feel other people's emotions.
I need to turn that shit
now.
Down. A little bit now.
It's hard, right?
Man.
It sucks sometimes.
I cry more than I feel like is healthy.
You'll find the balance. I remember when we were younger, like I knew that you had an empathetic side. So I don't think that you were a narcissist at first. I think that addiction took over and you became that.
But the behaviors do have to be reprogrammed. They do have
Absolutely.
To be, and they can be reprogrammed. I want people to have hope here. It's not lost. They can be reprogrammed.
Yeah.
Things can get better. They will get better. So,
well, if they're doing what they're supposed to do.
That's a roundabout way of saying that we're all born with, we're born and then our, you know, nature, the way we're raised sort of forms our ideas about the world and how we treat other people. And then addiction takes that and it arrests it. So you don't.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's arrested development.
You're not growing and really learning new things because parts of your brain are physically different. Your prefrontal cortex is not operating like a normal person's prefrontal cortex. Your desire centers of your brain are overactive. It's all it's thinking about is I need, want, pleasure, need this.
Well, I'm just going to simplify it. Let's say you start drinking at the age of 17. Most 17-year-olds are not emotionally mature, right?
No.
Like they don't know.
Males? Hell
they
no.
don't know how to deal with their emotions. They don't
no.
know how
and
to do a lot
too.
Of things.
Yeah, most of us.
They don't know how. I mean, they're like young children and they were not taught how to really deal with their emotions. So they start drinking at 17. Let's say they're drinking from the age of 17 to 32. When they stop drinking, they're going to have the brain of a 17-year-old.
When it comes to their emotional availability. When it comes
to their emotional
else,
availability.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's going to take time for them to recover from that.
Big time. So yeah, that's what I've always looked at it as a form of arrested development.
So that's what causes the behaviors too. Once the substance is gone, like they're there. They were there before.
Yeah. Yeah. You are a 17-year-old brain dealing with like our mind emotionally dealing with the input that a 30-something-year-old responsible for with kids,
so children,
and
a wife,
a job.
Responsibilities, home,
you
like
don't
all
have
of that.
The
you
tools
don't have
or the
it.
Skills to deal with these things. No. That's exactly what it felt like to me. Mm-hmm. It's like when I got sober, I'm like, I'm 17, but I'm not.
Yep.
This sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible, but you can learn. You catch up quick too.
Yep. Okay, so I liked this one. Setting boundaries aren't as simple because you can't just say, I'm removing myself if you continue to drink. All right, so I encourage people to set boundaries based on behaviors and not alcohol anyway. So it might be better to say, I'm going to remove myself if you are being disrespectful to me.
If you talk to me that way.
If you speak to me this way. If you throw something. If you're verbally abusing me. If you are lying about something. Like, you can set boundaries based on behaviors, not based on the substances. Because I'm going to tell you this, you're removing yourself if they continue to drink. They're still going to have those behaviors.
Yeah.
And so it's all about what your values are and what, you know, you deserve to be, how you deserve to be treated.
That's a great point. Yeah, it's about the behaviors, period. It's not just about the substance. It's easy to look at the substance and say, that's going to be my boundary, is going to be all about that substance. Mm-hmm. Remember, it's a bucket called sobriety. It's not actually sobriety. It's about behaviors.
Yes.
It's a bucket of behaviors. It's a bucket of Brian.
But I can understand if that's what you're doing right now and you have to start somewhere. Totally get it. But when it comes to them being dry drunk, this is where you can really start to focus on behaviors.
Yeah. And so if you're unclear on boundaries, we did a series on boundaries that a lot of people have found helpful. Give it a listen. It's a three-part series.
Three parts. Really, we have a formula. It's great.
Really helps you work through it.
All right. How do you know if they are a dry drunk or a narcissist?
Oh, we went through this.
It doesn't matter.
Go.
It doesn't matter. I know why this question was asked, because if they are a dry drunk, you can just say, all right, you know, there's a lot of hope there, because, you know, if they just work a program, they can shift their behaviors and whatnot. A true narcissist can't change, blah, blah, blah. In this moment, at this time, how is this person treating you? Whatever they're doing, and if it is abusive, it is affecting you. It is going to affect you. You are going to have problems from that. So it doesn't matter if they're a dry drunk or narcissist. What are their behaviors telling you at this moment, right now?
I think that's perfect. I have nothing to add to that.
Shocking. You sure?
Dang, man. A little
are
digs
you sure?
Over here.
What'd you call me?
A little digs over here.
I told you I'm on fire today.
Miss Diggs.
All right, so...
I love you.
How do I know when to leave when it's no longer active addiction? Again,
this was our question earlier that we talked about on the way home.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that this is a little by slow process, right? We've talked about the time frame. A lot of people have asked this question here lately. And if you don't know what question I'm talking about, people have asked, like, realistically, how long did it take me to get to where I am today?
Mm-hmm.
And your answer is?
8 years.
About 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
8 years of sobriety and recovery.
Before.
Of working hard, core recovery. Not dabbling in it.
It's, yeah, I wasn't a tourist.
This was going to 30-day treatment, 90 meetings in 90 days, IOP, still working at treatment centers, having a sponsor, having sponsees, like everything. And it still took that long.
Yeah, like really studying this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little by slow process, man. It takes time to rewire your mind. It takes time to develop skills. It takes time to really, truly... I'm a slow learner, I think.
No, you're not.
It takes me time to truly comprehend things.
Yeah.
Like, truly understand, like... I can understand a concept pretty quickly, but to apply that concept and to see it all around is different.
I think it might take you a while to understand how it affects somebody. That might too. Be the difference.
That too. Yeah, like... This is a little by slow process, but when to know when to leave. Okay. Here's what I would say. This is just my opinion on this thing. I'm not hopefully telling anyone just to leave or not or whatever. This is just my opinion, right? This is what I think.
They know how we roll.
If someone's invested in a recovery program, they're worth investing in long-term. If they're not, F them, move on. It's not worth your time. You will be in this freaking cycle forever. You'll be 50 years old wondering, what the hell did I do? Waste my time on this. If someone is not going to address the underlying behaviors, this is not going to get better. Could it be muted at times? Will you have good days and bad days?
Absolutely.
Sure.
It's life.
But for the most part, they will still be that person.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll just be very, very quiet and detached from everything, and you won't get anything from them. If they're invested, it's worth waiting on. That's been my experience.
Yeah.
If they're invested in it, though, that doesn't mean being a tourist and showing up once a month to therapy. That doesn't mean like half-assing saying that you're in recovery and really not doing anything about it. Recovery is your priority. Your health is your priority. Like, your mental health is your priority. Your marriage is very important to you. This is the forefront of what I want in this life.
Mm-hmm.
If those things are present and you can look at those things and say, that's true, that's worth it. It's worth, it gets better.
Yeah.
If they're working it.
Yeah.
Stick around, it gets better.
Yes.
But if they're not, it doesn't get better.
No. And you're going to recognize different, you know, layers of things changing. You're going to recognize progress in different areas. You're not going to recognize progress in all areas at all. It just doesn't work that way with this.
It's a slow process. Like, you'll start to notice some of the, in the beginning, like, some of the big things change quickly and they keep you invested. And like, you'll see if they're really doing this, that, like, for us, it was like the parts that were the most egregious fixed themselves this, like, in the beginning. And
it's
ooh, and that makes you want more moving forward. And that's kind of how it worked naturally. It's like, ooh, now that's gone. That's great, man.
Yeah.
And then, oh, now this is gone. Like, what could be next? And you just, it keeps getting better and better and better and better.
Yeah.
If they keep on covering it.
Mm-hmm.
If someone just removes the substance, I wouldn't wait a day for that.
Yeah.
Like, you are signing yourself up for possibly worse treatment.
Yeah. Yep. All right. You're never happy even when I'm sober. You can't ever be satisfied with who I am. That's very, it's a narcissistic thing to say. Right?
I hate this poor me line of bullshit.
I don't like it either. The whole, like, you don't like who I am. You're never satisfied with who I am. Everybody needs to change. Everybody needs to grow. Everyone needs to do something different. We should never be satisfied with who we are right now. Like, we can be satisfied, like, happy, you know, and positive with who we are, but we still want to change. We want to be better every day. That's what growth is. So this is BS.
Boys say this. Boys, not men, boys say this kind of stuff. This is my take on it. When you've called me out on something that I'm obviously doing wrong, my only retort is that you don't love me for me. God forbid someone challenges you to be better. God forbid someone sees something in you and has asked you to step up. Mm-hmm. God forbid someone is challenging you to grow with them. God forbid. What a horrible thing.
Seriously.
Are you shitting me?
Yeah.
I hate seeing this.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry if your partner is saying this to you. It hurts my feelings and it breaks my heart that you're having to go through this, because that's not what an equal partner says. You know, that's not somebody who is trying to make their marriage work. It sucks.
Now listen, there is a line here for this too. Okay?
Okay.
If someone's working really hard and they're doing the work, but they've got a lot of work to do.
Yes.
Support them.
Agreed. Right?
It's not easy work.
I agree with that too. There's a great
attacking
area here.
Someone who's trying mm-hmm. is never a helpful thing to do.
Yep.
But you know the difference between trying and not trying.
Yeah.
Oftentimes people that say this kind of crap are people that are just dry.
Yeah.
And they've just removed the substance and they're still an asshole, and they know they're an asshole, and they know that they're not living up to their potential, and they know that they're not investing in the relationship or investing in being a father or cultivating a real marriage
mm-hmm.
or a home that is healthy for everyone. They know these things and you've called them out on it, and this is their retort. You don't love me for who I am. That is the weakest argument of all time. Do better than that if you're going to argue.
Don't take it to heart. I know that's easier said than done, but
personally, one of my favorite things about you is that you have never let me get away with mediocrity, ever. You've never settled for mediocrity with me, ever. And there were times,
I don't know if that's good or bad.
There were times when I was frustrated with it. There were times when I wasn't ready for it. There were times where I was truly annoyed and I said this kind of stuff. I'm mad. I get an emotional reaction because I've said that shit. Mm-hmm. I know that guy because I am that guy. I was that guy at one time. I said that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could go back and tell my younger self anything at all, is that that's a blessing, that she's willing to see that in you, that she's still here and she's challenging you. She sees something in you, mm-hmm. right? You don't see it, but she does.
Yeah.
And the day that I quit arguing with this kind of stuff, and I just said, you know what? You're right. And I knew that you were right. And I just, like, owned it. And I did the work and got better. Things got better. And it wasn't just because you quit yapping. It wasn't because you just quit arguing and calling me out. I got better. I was proud of who I was. Man. I liked the man that I saw in the mirror.
I hold on too tightly sometimes.
And I've always credited you for that, for challenging me. Like, there's a great man in you. And I see it. Quit bullshitting around and be him. And you never let me just be half-assed about anything. There are times where I'm like, yo, I'm doing everything I can right now. And you will back off.
But I will.
if I'm doing the work. Yeah. And it could be hurtful if someone's actually doing the work.
Yes. It's like, I agree with that.
I'm really trying.
Yeah.
But don't ever stop challenging anybody in your life to be better.
Agreed.
If you don't have friends around you that can do that for you, are those really friends?
Yeah.
These acquaintances.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's comfortable.
Yep.
That's not real. That's not growth.
All right. So what are the underlying issues that are left untreated?
Okay. So addiction is not a drinking is not the problem. We've heard that many times. It's a symptom of other problems. It's funny because I've heard this presented two ways. And like, I've got a friend who says like, dude, it's no more complicated than I just like the way getting drunk feels. And that's the way he looks at it. He's like, I just like getting drunk. I didn't grow up in a bad home or anything else, but I think it's deeper. I think that he would be the first to admit it's probably a little bit deeper than that. There are issues that exist that we use alcohol for as an anesthetic of sorts. You can go pee. Okay. There are issues that we use as an anesthetic. Some of these are depression. Some of these are anxiety. Some of these are trauma from our past that we've never dealt with. And there's ADHD. I mean, there's a lot of underlying issues that are attributed to someone that seeks substance to comfort. It is an anesthetic. They use it like a medication. I used it like a medication. I used it like I would, like people use Tylenol when you have a headache. I used hydrocodone whenever I felt sad. That's the only way I could describe it. So there are a lot of underlying issues that are beneath the surface, and they vary, and they are serious problems. They are serious problems, which is why you have to treat the underlying diseases. You have to treat the underlying disorders, the underlying issues, or you're never going to get anywhere, ever. That's been my experience with it. I had to really, really uncover the stuff underneath the surface before I ever made any real progress, because I had tried to stop on my own more times than I can freaking count. And just removing the substance did very little to get me anywhere further to being happy in my own skin. It did nothing in getting me happy in my own skin. Okay, what were your experiences with the underlying issues?
With you?
Yeah.
Or
other ones that you've seen from people. You work with a lot of people.
What did you just talk about?
About depression, anxiety, disorders like ADHD.
Childhood trauma.
Unresolved trauma.
Control issues.
Yep.
Just thinking of the world a certain way.
Selfishness, self-centeredness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beliefs and attitudes that are contrary to the way the world generally operates.
Yeah, and just not knowing how to manage, manage your emotions.
Now, listen, here's the thing about addiction where I think people get twisted is that is this a sick person? Yes, this is a sick person. This is often a person, too, that has been abused or traumatized. This is a person that's been through a lot. Whether or not they want to admit it, it's a person that's been through a lot in life. They have, and this is the outlet that they've chosen.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get mad at someone that is obviously struggling, but that does not excuse the behaviors. And although these things happened, the depression, the anxiety, the unresolved trauma, the abuse to them, they're not your fault, but they are your responsibility.
Exactly.
Still your responsibility.
Yeah. So
those are the things we need to focus on. And those are the things that, like, for me, like in the 12 steps, every one of these was hit on. Every one of these things was talked about. I've discovered every one of them, and I've dealt with them sober. You think that depression just completely magically goes away whenever you get sober?
Right.
No, I've been depressed and sober.
Yeah, you have all of the emotions. You say you feel everything stronger, you just know how to deal with it now.
Yeah, these are normal emotions that people have. These are normal things people have. I have ADHD.
And you're not passing it on to somebody else. When people still have underlying issues and they're not addressing it, they are going to pass it on and affect other people.
Yeah.
And it's up to us to not, you know, to set boundaries and not tolerate certain behaviors so that they do have to dig into their issues so that they can heal from them.
Yeah.
The longer we allow it to happen, the longer they're going to stay within their untreated issues.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that's just how it is.
Absolutely.
They have to have those, I don't want to say suffer the consequences, because it's not really consequences. It's something, it's almost a gift for them to have to deal with their underlying issues. Because then they're becoming a better, human being. They're able to deal with life a little bit better.
Emotions buried alive never die.
Exactly.
They will come back. You have to face these things eventually. And the only way out is through.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is the last question. Why are sugar or smoking addiction so necessary for these for dry drunks? Matt, you touch on this one.
Okay.
Dopamine.
Dopamine. It boils down to dopamine and compulsive behaviors, right?
Yeah.
When I was in treatment, I started smoking cigarettes, and I'm not a smoker.
Well, you were. We both smoked cigarettes for a little. We smoked off and on for years.
But when I went into treatment, I was using tobacco. You were chain smoking. I was using Copenhagen.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. But I didn't use Copenhagen unless I was buzzed. Like, I didn't do it when I was sober.
Oh.
It like increased the buzz.
Right.
So it became like a compulsive habit for me. When I got sober, they took away caffeine. And in my treatment center, they took away caffeine.
Yeah, this is weird. They took away caffeine, but they encouraged us
to smoke or do something. Okay, here's where I'm at, right? We have a hierarchy of problems, right? I am a heroin addict. I drink alcohol. I abuse cocaine sometimes. And now we're going to sit here and hark on sugar and coffee and cigarettes. Let's deal with one thing at a time.
No, I understand.
That's where I'm at. So why are these things needed though? Dopamine. It's a vice of some kind. Mm-hmm. I need something, right? So I chew nicotine gum.
It's
a thing I do.
Yes.
It's like a neurostimulant. I like it. Is it a major, it doesn't cause cancer. It's just nicotine. It's just the substance of nicotine. Neurostimulant. I like it. Could I stop it? Absolutely. Is it causing massive issues in my relationship, in our marriage?
No.
I'm not going to worry about it, but it's something for me. Will I always have something? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some things that are less dangerous than others and less, you know, have less consequences? Yes.
Right.
I gained 70 pounds my first year sober.
Yes, you did.
I ate every feeling I had.
Mm-hmm.
Every
so
one of
them. So much candy.
Talking about my drawer.
You had a candy drawer and your nightstand was full of candy wrappers.
Like when she says full.
Oh, I'm talking full. And it's a big
dog over here causing issues.
It's okay, pup. It was like a big drawer full of candy and a
full
candy
of
wrappers,
Snickers
like
wrappers and Reese's and
I have a picture.
Three
somewhere,
Musketeers,
I'm sure.
And all kinds of stuff.
You've always been addicted to sugar. Oh my God, Winnie Beans. You've always been addicted to sugar. You were addicted to it, I think, as a child, right? Like it was always something. You always had that gene.
Yeah. So am I ever going to be perfect? No. Like, will there be a day I don't use nicotine at all? Probably. Will there be a day that I'm not like in love with sugar? Probably not. And I'm just going to live with certain things like that. But really, I think one day I might even get to the point where I'm like, you know what? I really want to address all this stuff. Because I want to discover what's underneath the nicotine. I want to discover what's underneath the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to. I'd love to get there. Just right now, it's like, I got a lot of shit going on. I need a little bit of coffee.
It's not affecting us. Like, let's say that it was affecting us financially.
Yeah,
you know, then,
like
yeah,
we're spending
that's
too much
like
on Nicorette,
smoking,
dude.
If that's affecting people financially. Plus, smoking does cause harm to you.
We would absolutely go down that road.
But that's, again, it's not affecting the spouse necessarily, you know, unless you're like, I don't want to be around cigarettes, and that's your deal, not theirs. You can't have somebody stop, you know, smoking cigarettes or whatever. You just got to remove yourself from that situation. But yeah.
Like I knew a guy who was, his drugs of choice, it was alcohol and cocaine. And he also drank, I think it was like Dr. Peppers or something like that. And he smoked cigarettes and he was like really gung-ho on sobriety. He's like, I'm just going to stop everything. You talk about a miserable dude.
Oh my gosh.
Like when you're, it's hard enough to stop alcohol, cocaine.
When you stopped and you got out of treatment, we started a weight loss program together.
How long did that last me?
A week. Your sponsor told you to stop doing that now because you
were
moody.
Yeah.
Yes. You were not handling
well. He's like, dude,
well,
we'll address the
all.
Weight thing eventually, but like,
right now,
old timers and old timers in AA give guys hard candy when they're fresh. It's like, eat these as often as you need to. It's okay.
It's because your sugar is, once you stop drinking, so when you drink, it turns in, it's sugar. It's sugar. So your body's getting sugar. When you stop drinking it, your body's going to crave that sugar.
Yeah, you're going to crave something
so
like that.
So you need
and it's
to have
just, it's craving that little something. I have to have something to look forward to. So something sweet.
No, it's really like the sugar thing. It's a thing because you stopped eating sugar and it was bad.
Yeah.
It was bad.
Really bad. I was so angry. Y'all, I've come off of almost every drug known to man. And the worst withdrawal like mentally I've ever had in my life, it was sugar. Sugar was like
yeah,
the
you've
worst.
Told a lot of people because like with our fitness program, it's a health and fitness program. I had a sugar withdrawal and it was awful. And you were telling everybody like that is the most difficult withdrawal I ever had was from sugar.
It's so mentally taxing because it's mm-hmm. something that's like right there and you know it's not like crazy harmful, even though it's arguably one of the most harmful substances we put in our body.
It's very, very harmful.
So bad for you. But yeah. it's just always there. And like we are...
It's in everything that we eat.
We are biologically programmed to seek sugar. Mm-hmm. Like that is a treat for humanity of all time.
Yeah. We know a lot about this. We could go on,
but
on
anyway,
about this. But about...
They're craving something, some excitement, some stimulus, something. Mm-hmm. So, and truthfully, frankly, when I work with people, I tell them like, dude, you can eat the cake. You can smoke or whatever. Like we will deal with these things. We need to get you right first.
Yep.
And you can be, you know, mentally, spiritually, physically right. And then we'll work on your diet and we'll talk about smoking and everything else. Like let's cover these big things first.
Yeah.
And then we'll get to the rest of it.
I think that you quit smoking pretty quickly when you got home because we had a baby.
I remember one time.
You smoked one time?
When I got out of treatment, I went to a meeting at the Preston Group in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I met a bunch of guys from treatment who were there. And we'd all been smoking and treatment together. And I got out. I remember standing on the curb next to my vehicle. I had a truck at the time. Can't remember.
Yeah, the truck.
And I was sitting there smoking and I'm like, this is disgusting. It's just not the same. Like not in treatment. It's really weird. Like I smell like it. My breath smells. My fingers stink now. And that was the last cigarette I ever smoked.
Yeah.
That was it. I was done with it. I was like, I'm done with it. So don't be too alarmed. Maybe it's a habit to pick up for whatever.
We've had a lot of people ask that question in the community about my partner, you know, picked up smoking in treatment and I don't know if I can deal with it. And I'm like, I always tell them it will be,
I get it.
It'll be okay. It'll be okay. You know, Matt did the same thing.
I personally don't know anyone that kept doing it.
But I didn't, right. And I mean, some people might, but even then I'm just like, it didn't bother me when you were in treatment. I didn't care.
You used
but
to bring me cartons.
I did. I was like, whatever, do your thing. I don't care. I have there's bigger fish to fry. And I just didn't want you to do it when we got home because we did have a 9-month-old Winnie Beans.
My dog's acting okay. Cool.
All right.
Hey, something else people do, they will often seek sex as an outlet too.
Mm-hmm.
Like you might notice like...
Extra sex drive?
Not even so much that. It's not even so much the drive. It is the need to feel different. So it's porn, it's masturbation. It's
It's having the dopamine kick.
Yeah, it's once that. Again, it's that. So, but there are healthy levels of this. I would say quote unquote healthy. Like this is like gray area thinking here.
Of course.
Of things. I think that they're all damaging to some degree, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Some of these we can live with, some of them we can't. So nicotine, caffeine, sugar. Okay. We start getting into sexual behaviors, gambling, compulsive behaviors that can really be damaging to a relationship. Hang on. We got to back up again. Those things can be a little rough. Those things can be really rough.
Eventually, you can start getting those highs from doing things that you enjoy.
Exercise is how I found my outlet.
Watching a good movie.
Stimulating conversations for me are like getting high.
Yeah.
Like the podcast even, like talking right. to you, like looking for words and getting them out, like that is stimulating to me. I love it. I get a dopamine kick from that.
That's great.
I love reading and talking about new ideas
that's
with people.
That's what we're naturally supposed to be doing is getting it from stuff like that.
And you will find it. Early on though, eat the cake.
No, I know. I'm saying that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But eventually you'll get to a point where you do it in healthier outlets.
For sure. It gets better.
Yeah.
So I hope this is helpful. Hope this answers some questions about dry drunk. I think it's a topic that a lot of people have heard about, but not really sure about. I've got a lot of experience in dry drunk.
Yes. So I feel like we could even have another episode on this.
So if we miss something, if there's another question that I didn't answer that you'd like to know more on, please. I've got tons and tons of experience. No, I know a lot of dry drunks. Mm-hmm. I've worked with them over the years. I deal with them probably on a regular daily basis.
Right.
So yeah.
Yep.
Very familiar with the dry drunk. I'm with you. It's tough. Sure. Hang in there. Don't forget to leave us a review. And check out our workshop. I really want to see people at the workshop.
Yeah.
I want to give you guys hugs. I want to see you. We want to see you. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yep.
We love you guys to death. So until next time, I'm Matt.
I'm Paige.
And we'll see you.
Bye.